Good morning. This is Dr. Matthew Dunn, host of The Future of Email. My guest today from Washington, D.C., correct? Area?
I have moved to Raleigh, North Carolina, but...
Ooh, even more interesting. Grace Aldridge Foster. I think it's fair to call you a writing expert, Grace, having read your background. Tell me a bit about you.
Yeah, sure thing. Yes, I live in North Carolina now with my dog, Indiana Jones.
Yeah. What kind of dog?
He's an adventurer and a scholar. He's a shepherd-a-doodle. He's half German shepherd and half poodle.
Nice.
And yeah, maybe he'll make an appearance. And I'm the co-founder of Bold Type LLC. I started the company with my business partner, Casey Mink, in 2018 after we met in graduate school. We were both getting a master's in English thinking, what do we do with this now? And the rest is history.
You got two masters in that area, right?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so we'll get to email and writing and all that other corporate stuff eventually, but I've lived this as well. It's a little weird. Going from the halls of grad school to corporate in business.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for so many reasons, but you know, especially because I'm a writing expert. I mean, the way you are trained to write in academia is basically the exact wrong way to write in any other context.
Bless you for saying it. What's wrong about, I agree. What's wrong about it in your take?
Yeah, well, I say this with full respect to the many academics in my life that I love and appreciate. But, you know, I think a lot of academics are writing to show off what they know. and they have to. I mean, I'm really not roasting them for that.
Publish or perish.
The whole system is set up for this. So, you know, typically academic writing is, of course, pretty loquacious. It's lots of big words. It's long-winded. It's all that. And also it's often very focused on this is what I know. Let me share my expertise with you. Let me show, you know, let me share all the details that I know. But email communication in particular, but really any other type of writing outside of that context is not really about what you know. It's about connecting with your audience. It's a conversation. It's about inviting them in. And so I think, you know, there are a lot of really tactical things you learn to do in academic writing that you should not do in any other kind of writing. Like, don't put your thesis statement, you know, that's like the last sentence in your first paragraph. That's like, we know that that's a dead zone. People will skip over it when they're skimming and scanning your writing. Don't save your conclusion for the end, you know, lead with your mic drop, right? Like, so there are really tangible things you learn to do in academic writing that are just not right.
including the colon and the second piece of the title, which is...
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Right? Dead giveaway. I spent some time in academia.
Yes, and I'm definitely a serial offender in my academic career of that.
Yeah, I mean, and it, is stodgy a fair label? Okay, like... Yeah, somehow academic writing, and I realize it, you know, it's focused on a narrow and expert audience, and that's a fairly key distinction as well, right? If I'm an academic writer and fill in the blanks, I'm going to assume that the people reading my output are interested in or close to expert in the stuff themselves. Like, we're talking in code.
Yes.
To some extent, right?
And, yes.
And email and business communications... It certainly happens inside companies, in my experience, that you end up talking in code and jargon and internal references and things like that. But generally speaking, your audience isn't necessarily have the interest or time to be in on the code.
It's so true. And if you think about kind of the, at least, you know, I'm my background's in the humanities. If you think about kind of the point of that academic research, you know, people are taking something that seems simple and their job is to tease the complexity out of it. You know, it's to probe the complexities of something that seems simple. But in almost any other context, your job as a professional is to take something that seems complex and simplify it for other people. So the aims of your writing are completely different.
Almost opposite, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, almost opposite. You've worked with a wide variety of folks in the worlds that you've touched in your business, including the military, I was interested to see. Tell me about that a bit.
Yeah, I had no idea that Navy SEALs also send emails until I started working with them. Yeah, it's I started doing that work about 8 years ago now. I was still a grad student and kind of got recruited to teach concise writing to special operations teams. And so I was flown down to Southern Pines, North Carolina, which is outside of Fort Bragg. And I showed up to shadow a class. You know, that was then the founder of the company that morning goes, "Hey, you know, I had a meeting come up at Fort Bragg today, now Fort Liberty. So you got this, right?" And I was like, "What are you talking about? Got what?" And he ushered me into a room with 16 Green Berets and left. I didn't see him the rest of the day. I taught the class. I guess it went well because I'm still doing it 8 years later. But
wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I could get the need to be concise. No battle plan survives the first minute of the battle or whatever the quip is. What's the biggest adjustment you've seen as helping your students make in their writing in that particular context, military?
Yes. Well, I guess some of the background or the context for why these folks need writing training is that, you know, a lot of them enlisted out of high school or whatever. Now they're, you know, doing these very high stakes operations. They have to write reports and those reports get passed up, you know, sometimes they end up at the Pentagon, right? And so you have, you know, people who are highly trained professionals, extremely smart, extremely capable, but they're being tasked to write for a really high level audience when they haven't specifically had that training. So that's kind of the context for why we come in and teach writing classes. And I think the two things, it's two sides of the same coin that I see that we have to adjust for, help them adjust for the most often is just level of detail. Because you get two extremes in the military, and this is true for other industries as well, but you either have folks who include, they're way too short and direct, and there's not nearly enough detail. And then on the other side, you have folks who are way too into the weeds, you know, they're subject matter experts, they go into way too much. So helping them gauge the appropriate level of detail for the particular genre or format, and then for that audience is really what.
Okay. Yeah, it makes a ton of sense, and I can see how there'd be a temptation to land on either side. You've got highly skilled, highly trained, pretty darn deadly folks who are probably in at least some of them are like writing reports scares the bejeepers out of me, right?
Oh yeah, I don't get to. I don't get to read those reports. They are classified. And you know, it's funny though, because I think writing makes people feel very vulnerable. And so I have these, you know, frankly, these badasses in the room who jump out of planes and they get shot at and all this. But then I ask them to I project their email on a screen in front of the rest of the class and they're like shaking it, you know?
So, yeah.
It just has a way of really making you feel vulnerable and insecure, I think. And it's been really interesting to observe.
You hit one of two brackets about what petrifies people. Certainly writing and getting your writing sort of public or read, married very closely with public speaking, which apparently is the number one adult fear, right?
You know, I've never heard that, but... That does sound.
I'd read, and I'm sure it's apocryphal, and it's probably baloney. And I didn't look on Snopes, but statistically, more people are afraid of public speaking than dying.
Well,
I know, right?
Wow. Oops. Yeah.
And I mean, why? Why is writing and even speaking different form of writing, perhaps? Why is it scary?
You know, I think that your writing speaks for you when you aren't in the room. And so I think there's this, it feels very high stakes because one, all of your possible, say, mistakes are there on the page. You know, you can't hide them. But also you aren't there typically when someone is reading your writing. You're not physically there to gauge their reaction to course correct, you know, and also... You know, you don't have your facial expressions and your body language to help ensure that your intended message is getting across. But I think people have a real fear of being misunderstood in writing. And then I think also they feel very exposed, like their they worry a lot about their spelling and their punctuation and things like that. And I mean, I think some of that fear goes back to like middle school, you know, when your teacher was red penning your papers or something.
Yeah.
Interesting.
This is a lateral maybe, but in other professional activities, I ended up doing a lot of voiceover recording, as well as having a background in theater before that. So as I was doing the voiceover work and writing most of the screenwriting that was being recorded as well, and I got really intrigued, and still am, with the difference between how we speak and how we write. I know any number of people I find wonderfully articulate out loud who vapor lock the minute they're setting, fingers to keyboard or pen to paper, or, you know, pick your physical metaphor. Have you seen that as well?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I have. And this is an old writing center trick. That's kind of where I got my start. I was working in college writing centers, you know, doing one-on-one writing tutoring and that kind of thing. And, whenever I work with someone who says they have writer's block, they're struggling to get words on the page, they're struggling to get started or whatever, I'll ask them, okay, put down your pen, you know, take your fingers off the keyboard and just talk to me, explain to me. You know, let's say it's an academic paper. Explain to me your argument or the point that you're trying to make here. And people can do it perfectly. They can articulate their thoughts perfectly. And so then I'll say, so just write that down.
Yeah. Well, but keep running with that for a second. And I'll go back to the voiceover stuff. What I noticed, and I've seen the same thing as automated transcripts, like what I'll end up with from this conversation, have become more readily accessible. The structure of spoken language is not the same as the structure of written language. The perfectly adequate explanation of your key point out loud isn't the same set of sentences that you'd put on paper. And I don't think speaking and writing are necessarily exactly the same use of language. I suspect we'd see different cells firing if we were looking at a brain scan or something like that. But they still dive back to the same clear thought.
Mm-hmm.
Like, huh. And man, when you look at it statistically, and we'll end up talking about AI, darn it. But as you look at it sort of statistically, speaking a coherent sentence is kind of a bloody miracle. Like, it's a complicated thing we're doing.
Yeah.
And we just do it. This.
Yeah. Yes. And usually I think when people do speak perfect sentences, it's because they've written it first. It's because they prepared a speech, or they've brainstormed or prepared in some way. But I think, Matthew, that one of the reasons that our writing looks so different from our speaking, like literally the sentences are different, even if we're communicating the same thought, is that when people, we can't edit our speaking, right? So basically when we speak, it's a rough draft. So I think if you look at a truly bad, intentionally bad, like rough first written draft, it would look a lot more like the way we speak. But writing, you know, the end product that people see is not usually where we start.
No. You know? True. Good writing is rewriting, right? That's an interesting point. So go back to the Writing Center for a second. That started you off on this. Helping people master this ornery, pesky, difficult thing called writing is fun?
Is it fun? Is that what you're asking me?
Yeah,
I think so. I mean, I really enjoy doing that kind of work as a student. And then and now it's very similar work, just sort of like scaled up and with different types of folks. But I often joke that writing training is really like therapy. Because people have to.
It makes a lot of sense.
Yes. Especially one-on-one coaching, but even in a group setting, which I do most of my work in a group setting now. But there are so many things that come up for people when you're doing these sessions, when you're doing coaching sessions or group training. And I find it really fascinating because we're talking, you articulate yourself as the reason we're there, but we're also working through people's, you know, the clarity of their ideas, their confidence, the way they want to be perceived by other people, their insecurities. I mean, there's so much that's wrapped up into it that I do find it fun. I find it really interesting, but it's not necessarily the, you know, like the technical skills that I think is fun. For me, it's the, it's sort of everything that that's baked into them.
Is it also, I'm curious your perspective, is it also a factor for people, the frustration of the gap between how clear it is in their head, how difficult it is to capture, convey, you know, communicate in a fundamental sense, whatever that is?
Yes, people communicate frustration with that constantly. Yes. And I think it's because when they start to write, when they start to put pen to paper, they're immediately thinking about the end product. And so they're trying to make that leap immediately to the end product. But we, none of us write in final drafts. You know, that that's just not the way that process works.
I don't know. I had a few term papers at about two in the morning that were pretty much had to be final drafts, or I was
dead. Well, sure. Pressure does things to all of us.
Pressure does things to all of us.
That's right. Yes. But it's not a reliable way.
No.
Yes.
And you bullshit your way through this. That's really what we're talking about there.
And some of us are better at that than others. Well, but you know what? There are ways to sort of conjure up pressure on demand. If that's the way you write best, then there are ways to sort of produce that for yourself without actually waiting till the
boy, so many avenues we could wander around down here. One of the ones that occurred to me, it's I'm being a smarty pants, but it'll actually give us a decent conversational branch. I'm older than you are, and I remember writing before software and screens and computers, and it was a lot harder because rewriting a page meant rewriting every word on the page.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the conversational branch that intrigues me. It'll get us to email eventually. That's not necessarily the case now. I suspect there's a lot more partial rewriting of word sentences, et cetera, a lot of redrafting, but you're not like throw out that paragraph or retype it verbatim, which you were forced to do with a pen, pencil, typewriter earlier. Do you think that's changed writing, and do you think it's changed it for the better?
Well, that's a really good question. Of course, I don't think that there's a simple answer to it. I do think that the way people write has changed drastically because of technology, for sure.
Yeah.
I think that there's a big risk there because writing and editing are fundamentally different cognitive tasks. And what I notice is that people, but when they're drafting on computers, they're trying to do both things at the same time. They're trying to write and edit at the same time. So they're trying to multitask. And if any of my, you know, clients or students listen to this, they're going to laugh because they've heard me say this a million times. But, you know, our brains don't actually multitask well. We're task switching when we try to write and edit at the same time in Microsoft Word, when we see the little, you know, squiggle pop up under our word and we're like, oh, we misspelled that, or that's not, you know, we get sidetracked, we go back and edit. I see people hit backspace, you know, a lot until a sentence is perfect. But what you're doing is you're rapidly trying to switch back and forth between writing mode and editing mode. And you end up, you know, with a drastic, I think, drop in productivity. So I've actually, even though, you know, you certainly can try to write and edit at the same time now, in a way that you couldn't when you were writing with pen and paper, I encourage clients to try not to do that. You know, if you're using Grammarly, which I recommend, make sure it's turned off while you're in drafting mode. Don't turn it on until you're ready to edit, that kind of thing, because otherwise you're going to really slow yourself down and kind of paralyze your thought process as you're trying to draft.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Like just that observation about those two things being, which I hadn't thought of, honestly. But a lot of people write a lot of email. Knew we'd get there eventually.
Yes.
And for the most part, they don't edit. They just vomit and hit send. And we all end up throwing it back and forth over the net until maybe we eventually have a mutual understanding, or maybe not.
What? That's right. I think those mutual understandings don't actually come very often. I think usually that volley ends up with, should we just get on the phone or do we?
Yeah. And yet we use it and volume goes up. Like, you know, it's like, and I know there's marketing, there's spam, stuff like that, but email volume's climbing at, you know, 18 to 20% per year still, despite all the other channels. And then we'll end up talking about texting and other channels, but just on that, email is sort of the probably primary written digital communication carrier, at least right now. It's got a lot of shortcomings as a channel, doesn't it?
Oh, it sure does. Sure does. And I think also our communication is so diffuse now. I mean, there's email. It's still kind of the cornerstone of workplace communication. But then it is also so common now for folks also to communicate constantly via Slack or Microsoft Teams or Signal or text throughout the day. I certainly do. And so I think that email has a lot of shortcomings, but then part of the reason that people abuse email so much, and I'm talking interpersonally, there's like spam and email marketing and sort of the mistakes you can make there. But then also just interpersonally, I think people misuse email constantly. And one of the reasons for that is because they're constantly switching back and forth between other writing platforms, other mediums. And so I think I think it's accidental for the most part, but they're not sort of pausing to go, okay, now I'm sending an email, not a Slack message. You know, what does that mean? How does this communication need to look different to match the medium that I'm using? It ends up kind of all just looking the same, which begs the question, why even have multiple channels? All messages are going to look the same in all of those places.
Yeah. And written email tends to look less like a written document and more like speech, but it's neither.
I would agree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a weird format. And I've watched this line blur over the years I've worked in the digital communication space. Slack, closer to conversation, but still not quite conversation. SMS texting, especially with groups, some of its own conventions. And I mean, for understandable reasons, right? A speech, I can't remember verbatim what you said 10 minutes later. I'm unlikely to text Slack. I can look back up and see verbatim what you said. That's a big difference there. But we end up in this, sort of constant churn. And I'm not sure we're doing each other favors by throwing the problem back across the net at the other guy. Like, did you mean X? If you phrase that poorly, you're not helping. I'm not quite getting to a point, but thoughts about the channels, plural?
Yeah, I think you are making really interesting observations. And so I guess the way I'm thinking about what you're saying is, like, if we go back to what email is, it's electronic mail. Right. So you think about like what an email looks like.
Yep.
It's sort of like this sort of perversion of like a letter, you know, of a written letter. Like there's still elements, the greeting, for example, and the sign off that's where that comes from. It's from written letters, you know. And so we sort of have this like strange evolution of like letter writing that's happening via email, kind of, but then we have this whole set of, you know, customs around email that are unique to it.
Yes.
And then, you know, Slack, and that's instant messaging. You know, the point is to be able to communicate instantly and, you know, about something. Email is really meant to be an archive. It's something that you can search for in your inbox. It's, you know, you're documenting something that you can search for later. And I think what gets really confusing is when one conversation or one topic starts out an email and migrates to Slack, and then there's a meeting and sort of like, so all the communication around this particular topic are like, it's like fragmented, you know, into all of these places. And that sort of is sort of mind blowing.
it is sort of mind blowing. And here I'll get to pick on one other thing I love to pick on. You couldn't possibly sit down in a lab with white coats and scientists and design a crappier communication format than reverse threaded email. My God, what a cognitive disaster.
It's so bad.
Oh, God, right.
Like, it's so bad.
You see these threads, and I've got some stuff going on involving lawyers right now. Lawyers freaking love email.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the threads are older than my children, I think. It's like, it just goes on, and you're like, you're looking at it trying to make sense later. Reading backwards.
Yes.
Not linearly, sort of, wait a minute, was this a response to this or that? How stupid is this?
Well, yeah, it's completely bizarre. It's completely bizarre. Nonsensical. But the thing is, too, it's perilous. Like, things get lost.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Get lost. So it truly is just such an ineffective.
Right?
Thing. Yes.
And we keep doing it.
We right? sure.
We keep doing it. And there are a lot of long of the tooth technical standards involved in forcing that. But even newer tool sets, and for some reason I'm thinking to pick on Superhuman, which is an email client. I used it for a while. Quite a good email client. That didn't change that. None of them have changed it, as far as I know. No one's tried to tackle the Gorgon of what happens if we kind of restructured this so you could make sense of the conversational flow. And I suspect it's because their machinery would melt the first time they hit a lawyer's inbox.
I think that's a good suspicion.
Yeah. Like, it's just nuts. It's just knuckleheaded. And at the same time, I suspect if you went to early conversations in this medium we're calling email, you know, like written, turned into digital with the personal inbox, which is a big deal, attached on either end, I suspect some of the same problems were there from the get-go.
Yeah.
It almost seems unavoidable unless we'd engineered it differently from the very beginning. Odd story, I hadn't thought about this in years, but there was collaboration platform. The name's escaping me. It was created by Ray Ozzie, who was the inventor of Lotus Notes. And it was a peer-to-peer platform. So this is probably 20 plus years ago. Peer-to-peer platform. And there was an odd side effect in that Groove. It was called Groove. In Groove, people could be working on the same thing simultaneously.
Okay.
And I remember I was in a conversation with three other people. It was a strategy session for something, but I'd pulled up a mind mapping application, you know, mind map. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
And I didn't realize that this could happen. Everyone was working on the mind map simultaneously, but everyone was working on different stuff.
Mm.
And when it sort of refreshed, I was jarred by how rich and interesting it was. Instead of it being a conversational ding, 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 ding around the table where we would build on, you know, thread A and add stuff to it, everyone literally went off on their own branches thinking that's what we were talking about simultaneously. And then seeing it concretely was just a shocker. And there aren't many channels that afford that well.
Yes.
I can't think of any. Maybe someone listening should go, ooh, there's an opportunity. But it just struck me how much the cadence of our channels constrains collaboration in its own way.
Yeah, as you were speaking, I had never really thought about the fact that literally the layout of email, like sort of like if you think about your inbox and sort of like the linear structure of it, yes. Right, like that defines and sort of constrains the way we use it. Wow. Yeah. I'm just like had this vision of an inbox that was not organized that way, but instead had sort of like circles or boxes and you could sort of expand them to see.
You know. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Well, you probably use Gmail. It's a safe
sure.
statistical
yes.
assumption.
Yes.
Gmail bringing the conversational grouping to email.
Mm.
That was a big shift for some of us who worked that way with email for decades or whatever. What do you mean the conversation back and forth about this with the same subject line and the same people is all in one little chunk in the inbox? I'm still not sure whether I loathe it. Right. But it's got some conveniences unless you accidentally delete it and things like that. But even that small reshaping, and for technical reasons, that was not easy, but that was a feasible thing to do, right? Same recipient, same subject line. This is a conversation. Okay, cool. I'll bet that has unconsciously really shaped how people use the channel as well.
No doubt. Yeah. But you know, something that constantly surprises me when I'm working with clients is just the vast differences between Gmail and Outlook, which, you know, I think are the two kind of most common. Anytime we teach like an email masterclass, and I start each email masterclass with asking people to tell me what their pet peeves about email are, because I've learned over time that people will complain incessantly for the full, you know, course about email.
Nice. So
if I give them an opportunity to do it and sort of get it out of the way. And also, I know exactly at this point what people are going to say. I know exactly what their complaints are going to be. I never, ever hear a complaint that's one I haven't heard before at this point. You know what I mean? But I think about just that. I think that I always forget, because I work mostly in Gmail and then a little bit in Outlook, and I sort of forget how different they are. And, you know, one thing that people always complain about with Outlook is how when someone sends you a meeting invite and then you accept it, it disappears from your inbox, right? And it's like, how has no one thought to like change that or fix that yet? Or maybe my info is outdated and they have. Correct me if I'm wrong. But, you know, that's not something that's an issue. And the different platforms have different problems. And so I think it's so interesting that it's not just like email. We have these problems with email or these things that frustrate us with email. It's like, it's highly platform specific too. And
Slack. Texting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And having been at companies designing some of those tools, Microsoft when Outlook was designed, for example, like there's an incredibly detailed and valiant attempt to address all of these things.
Yeah.
There are still decisions and assumptions and small hobgoblin of mine preferences that just get baked in.
Yeah.
Is there a preference that says don't delete, meeting invites? Yeah, maybe. But the two of us are talking. I have no freaking idea. You have no idea, right? And it is a big behavior shaping thing. And then flip it around. If you were the guy designing Outlook, and you said, you know what, once I've seen the calendar, I just make it go away. That's on at least one vector, a really sensible decision.
Sure.
Why do I want to keep them?
Right.
I may have my own reasons, but it seems a little dumb, said it boldly, right? You've seen it or the meeting's passed. Why on earth would you want to keep it? I don't know. Maybe a good reason. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Maybe it's actually like a really thoughtful, you know, effort to help you sort of unclog your inbox and and everything. But it's just interesting how often I hear people complain about that. And
that's a good idea, letting them bend.
Yeah, yeah. But I want to comment a little bit on you brought up the idea of preferences. And I think that, you know, we're talking about, you know, the sort of infrastructure of email is what you're talking about there. But when it comes to actually writing emails, this is something that is a constant negotiation, right? Like people write emails based on the way they prefer, based on their own preferences. But the thing about email is you're writing to accomplish something and it requires the participation of another person, of your recipient. And so constantly what I'm doing when I'm teaching is reminding people, you need to understand your audience's preferences and you need to write emails around their preferences, not yours, if you want to accomplish what it is that you set out to accomplish with your email.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha. And you've got one of your mantras. I can't remember the acronym you wrapped around it, but it's like sort of begin with the end in mind. Bottom line up front. Is that it? Bottom line up front?
Bluff, bottom line up front, which I learned from my military clients. Yes. Yep. And what's really funny, though, is they'll, it's very customary in the military to put literally BLUF, you know, like in bold at the top of your email, and then a one sentence, you know.
Summary.
Yeah, summary. The problem is that one sentence summary is rarely actually the most important point in the email. So I always joke, like, if your bluff isn't actually your bluff, then like, what are you doing? So it's sort of a funny thing that the military folks do, but yeah. So the bluff, put your bottom line up front. And then the other acronym we use a lot is the ART, the audience, result, and tone. How can you, you know, well, make sure that you know what the result is that you're aiming for with a particular message before you send it, who you're sending it to. So who you need that result from, yeah. And then what tone will move that particular audience to that particular result. And that helps you fight against, like, yeah. I'm going to structure this the way I prefer it, and helps you, you know, build empathy with your audience and think strategically, you know, and think, yeah. How can yeah. I do this the way they need it to be done?
Wait, yeah, nice. Nice. I like that. I see why you get repeat teaching engagements. My observation would be that companies, organizations, overinvest in the technological means and underinvest in the fluency facility with yeah. those means. A zillion-dollar email system and lots of people doing stupid things is not necessarily a great investment in communication. And we keep doing it over and over.
Yeah. Do you know, email is just this massive gap in training. People yes. just yes. employers
yes. Absolutely.
Just assume.
Absolutely.
They just assume that their workforce knows how to do it.
Right.
But why? No one ever is taught formally how to write email. You don't learn in high school. You don't learn in college. And so I think you're spot on. Like, companies invest in platforms. They invest in technology, but then they just assume that it's something that their employees know how to do.
Yeah.
Why would they know how
why
to
would
do
it? Why would they know? How, yeah. Why would they know? Yeah. Thanks for saying it. Why would they know? And the actual, I'm sure, measurable cost of not doing that is got to be ginormous.
That's
aside crazy. From mistakes made, just time sucked up, not wasted, sheer exhaustion.
Yes, and money. I mean, oh, man. Money. So, yeah, I mean, imagine if every company just took, during their onboarding process, yeah. just yeah. took a little while. One module, one meeting, whatever it looks like, and just said, here are a set of best practices around emailing using our platform and sort of in this industry yeah. or company.
Yeah. yeah.
It would be massive time savings, money savings, absolutely. You know.
Yeah. No. Absolutely. Or here's a new line of business for you. Or, you know, bring someone in as the free floating coach / you know, critic. If you realize that, you know, Joe in accounting is a complete flipping disaster in everyone's mm-hmm. inbox. You pull him aside and say, Joe, yeah. we just need to help you understand how to use this channel effectively. It's actually going to pay off handsomely for you and the entire company. And please stop doing reply all. Thwack.
Yeah, just think, yeah, that and it seems so simple, it's, doesn't it?
Yes, I couldn't agree more. Couldn't agree more. Well, Here's a probably guilty of having told this story before, but I read a wonderful book, The History of the Pencil by Henry Petrosky. I know. Why would you read that book? It was interesting. And he opens the book. I can't take credit for the anecdote. He opens the book with an observation about Thoreau. I'm going to go off and live in Walden Pond and live a simple life. And he started by listing off the stuff he was going to take to the mm-hmm. pond to live this simple life. What's the one thing not on that list? The pencil he wrote it with. And the real punchline is the Rose family was in the business of manufacturing pencils.
Oh my gosh.
And the point is, a successful technology becomes invisible. Mm-hmm. And of course, everyone knows how to write email. Perfectly mm-hmm. good example of that. No, they don't. Not write, write's part of it, but write and use.
Yes. Because
they're not quite the same thing. Not at all the same thing. you mind picking on texting, or sorry, discussing texting and instant messaging a little bit? What do you think?
Sure.
Where do you start?
I mean, you know, I personally do text constantly with my business partner, for example.
We all do.
Our assistant, right? Like it's just the most efficient means of quick, bite-sized, you know, communication throughout the day.
Yes.
So I certainly do that constantly myself, and you know, I think it makes a lot of sense just in terms of the way that works. Of course, there's a risk there, right? If you're using your personal phone and you're texting constantly for work, and it can feel like you're always working. It can feel like you're never disconnected. I mean, boundaries can get blurred, absolutely. But, you know, I think that that's something I use constantly. All of my clients in one form or another use military Signal. You know, all my clients are talking to each other. All my military clients are talking to each other on Signal. But you can get away with a lot in text, right? You don't have to be grammatically correct. You don't have to, you know, your messages aren't going to get forwarded to someone else. So even though there is a record, you can take screenshots, it feels a little more ephemeral than, you know, than email. So you can be a little less guarded, I think. You can, I think people are less inhibited when they're using text, which is good and sometimes bad, you know, in a professional context, right? Yeah. Like, but what are your thoughts about it?
You even said it in just the examples you gave. Because of the incredibly tight constraints of the channel, it's most effective, and I think most often used, where there's shared relationship, shared context, shared knowledge, bunch of that. Like my back and forth texting thread with my best friend is novel length, at least, I'm sure. Yeah. And no one else would probably make any sense of it because we've got 50 years of history.
Right.
Right. That goes back and forth in the conversation. And I wouldn't have done that in email. What a pain in the ass. That would have. Oh God, I need an entirely separate inbox.
Right? Yeah.
But it works well. It feels different. It is different. It certainly changed writing though, which is something that intrigues me. The easy thing to pick on would be acronyms and shorthand that they seem to have started in messaging platforms and sort of become part of speech and vernacular. And it kind of makes sense because LOL is a lot easier to type than the entire phrase it stands for. And now it's part of the culture. You see texting phrases in email, but it's a largely, like the evolution of language always is, unexamined, accidental, goofy cultural set of artifacts, not anything done intentionally.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's also so spot on. And as you were talking, I kept thinking about emoji also. And also how, and like you said, with you, you know, when you text with your best friend, I feel that texting conversations, they adapt to ongoing ones. They adapt a lot to your relationship with that person.
Yes, agreed.
The type of language you use, the
cadence, frequency,
the frequency is all highly attuned to your relationship with a person. Whereas email, I think, is a little bit more like the way we use it is a little more rigid. There's like a slightly more static, you know, kind of set of conventions around email. But like I just keep thinking about emoji because it's almost impossible for me to imagine texting without them at this point. And which I think is generational to some extent. I don't think that everyone would say that.
It is.
But also the way, like, I use different emoji in different ways with different people, because you sort of develop this sort of like shorthand, you know what that, you know, that particular emoji means for the two of you, but I wouldn't necessarily use it with someone else. And the applicability point here is tone. I think that people struggle to communicate in tone when they're in email, when they're very accustomed to texting, because you have a range of things available to you in testing to convey your tone that aren't necessarily appropriate in email.
Quick side thought, I don't want to lose this thread. Just as companies would probably net out handsomely by investing in how to use email training, mm-hmm. I suspect how to use Slack training probably would still handsomely as well. Again, Slack and texting are not the same thing, but they share some attributes.
Slack is like if email and texting had a baby, I think.
A bit. Email, texting, and Google had a baby. I think I don't deliberately do not have much Slackness in my day-to-day because I find it bloody annoying for part. But I don't think Slack as an organizational tool works very well without a big search engine parked on top of it. Mm. You know, if you think reverse threaded email is a disaster, try the reverse thread of a Slack conversation without search to get to the point that you, if you happen to know the term, to get to the point that's there somewhere. Kind of a mess. The emoji evolution of emoji is kind of intriguing because I'm a big visual communication geek, so I've watched this fairly carefully, right? The Unicode character set with visuals showed up later. Texting was, and SMS especially, was ASCII text only at first. And the Unicode emoji set was really pretty slim initially. But people, and I think it happened with the younger users first, that emotional and tone shorthand of the right visual, it's extraordinary how effective it is. And the various committees involved in Unicode sort of got pushed by the world. Expand this, add to this. No, not everyone is pink, so think about that. Like, keep, and the scope of emojis getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And there's some really eloquent, witty, funny stuff that people do with emoji. Salud, that's really cool.
Yeah, it's this whole sub language.
Yes, it's a sub language. Yeah, absolutely.
And it's also just this massive cultural touch point, which I find fascinating. And, you know, I have a much younger sister. She's 12 years younger than me.
Okay.
And so I'm millennial, thoroughly millennial. She is thoroughly Gen Z. And like, she constantly roasts me for the way I use emoji, you know, emojis, like the laugh cry emoji, which is apparently just like, you know, so millennial of me. And, you know, really? She'll yes, yes. And so she'll, I think that's fascinating. I mean, there's a decade between us basically. And the way I and my friends and my contemporaries using emojis is different from the way she and her contemporaries are using emoji. And I think that that's fascinating.
That's really, really cool.
How nuanced it is, and yet how deeply encoded and universal it is as well.
Yeah, super encoded. Quick personal story. My dad, no longer with us, unfortunately. You know the little purple, sort of demon-y looking?
Yes.
On an iPhone? He used that. We never knew why. And he used that. And so now with my sisters and mom and myself, that little emoji is a dad reference. Like, and all that stuff got baked into that little character right there. So, wow, dad, 10-year gap. And do you have any sense of what you do that's, you know, a faux pas for a Gen Z with emojis?
Well, one of them is the laugh cry emoji. Apparently,
you're not supposed to use it.
It's like, it's just very basic of you. It's sort of like old and whatever. And so she, and I'm sure it's already changed by now, because that's the other thing, is I feel like the sort of Gen Z usage is like constantly adapting, whereas maybe millennial usage is like a little more rigid, which I think is part of what she's like roasting me about, is that it's like very predictable and sort of stodgy or something.
Okay.
So like, you know, several years ago, she sent me this tweet or something explaining how, you know, Gen Zs use like the skull emoji instead of the laugh cry emoji. You know, and again, this is all, if she ever listens to this, she's going to like cringe because I'm sure I'm explaining this all wrong at this point. But, and you know, it never would have occurred to me at that point in time to use a skull to show that I was like laughing really hard, you know, but it's, I'm dead, you know, like that's so funny.
Yeah.
I'm dead, you know.
Well, but look at the, I mean, this is interesting. Just like we can put our academic hats on for a second. It's interesting, the sort of deeper reference chain that younger generation has going there, that gets encoded and represented. It's not just in the emoji. It's the choice of the emoji in the particular conversation with the particular people. And you know, when you're in your teens, you have time to keep up with memes, and you get out of me like, I stopped giving a crap at some point. I do not have time or interest or whatever. It's just not efficient for my life to try to be that hip. Do I know who that musical act is? No, I'm perfectly fine with that. Right. And someone will make fun of her for fill in the blanks, you know, encoding at some point in the future. Like that's kind of natural. Right. That is pretty fascinating. Like, I don't know if we'll be able to pause and study this as scholars should at some point in the future, but it'd be pretty darn interesting to do it.
Oh, it would be. I'm sure someone is doing it. I should look into this a little bit more. But I think it's all really fascinating. And then you think about the implications, like the way that, you know, emojis are constantly changing and evolving. They're so nuanced. And then Grammarly, for instance, their tone detector uses emojis to describe the tone that you're using in an email or in something that you've written. So then what happens when those emojis actually like, they're not stable, they're constantly changing and evolving. And so I think that that's interesting too. It's like the system we're using emojis to gauge or to reflect some, to analyze something.
Mm-hmm.
But then what happens when that system itself is sort of constantly in flux and highly nuanced and audience dependent? You know?
Yeah. That well put and interesting. There's the standard, I think, Unicode emoji set in Slack, or do they have additional? I can't remember if they've got additional.
Oh, I'm not sure. Yeah.
Yeah, characters or not. I would bet you'd find within companies or Slack communities, I would bet you'd find some of the same kind of evolution of encoding pattern. And you find it, you know, frankly, it's what's happening with those visual characters is the same thing that happens with words and terms and language.
Yeah.
It's just a little more starkly visible because it's, you know, it's one whatever bit character that drops in there. You're like, wrong character. You are so old.
Right. It's like this one character so much
so much freight. Well, and you know, a true wit doesn't require a lot of words, right? Just the right, you know, FOMO kind of thing. Like, oh, that guy's really smart. He said just the right thing. Yeah. Interesting. I suspect we could probably do this for hours because I've completely lost track of time, but I don't want to lose track of your time. Where do you see yourself, you know, taking the business and the things you do?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a great question. You know, something that we're a service-based business, but something that we've been working on is we focus a lot on training experiences because I think especially around writing, well, people don't want to do writing training. People want to hire us, right? Employers want us to come in and do writing training. Employees are not excited about it. So we work really hard to make like our training experiences extremely engaging. The one thing that we've been trying to do as we grow the company is create, you know, self-paced training options so that we can scale, we can reach more people. But figuring out how to preserve a really fun, engaging experience when you're training on a topic that no one really wants to learn about is sort of one of our interesting challenges right now. To work on.
You did a shift from DC to North Carolina, you said at the beginning. Is that because enough stuff can be done virtually and then other stuff with travel that your own location doesn't really have to be tied to the business?
Exactly. I mean, most of our, you know, in-person training is still East Coast. We have some clients, you know, we travel sometimes around the country, but mostly it's East Coast. And so it's an easy flight if I need to be in person, but most of our training is still virtual. You know, it went 100% virtual during COVID and, you know, people are returning to in-person training, but it's certainly not back to the same, you know, kind of percentage it was before the pandemic. So yeah, I can kind of live anywhere. My business partner lives in Miami Beach. I live in Raleigh.
There you go.
We have team members in Pittsburgh and Nashville and, you know, kind of spread around and it's great.
That's awesome. Well, Grace, if someone says, oh man, do we need her help? Where do they go to find you?
They should go to boldtype.us. That's our website. And it's very easy to get in touch with us from there. But I'd also love to connect with people on LinkedIn. It's Grace Aldridge Foster, and it'll be great to hear from folks.
Well, Grace Aldridge Foster, it has been a true delight talking with you. Thanks so much for making the time.
Thank you, Matthew. It's a pleasure.
We're out.